This week on Retronauts, we're talking about the happiest games on Earth. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mackey. And today's topic is Kingdom Hearts 3. And of course, we'll be talking a bit about the series as a whole. Before I go into this any further, who is here with me today?
It's me, Jeremy Parrish.
Jeremy's wearing his goofy suspenders as normal and his strange hats. Thank you for coming, Jeremy.
Yes, I'm a talking dog, unlike Pluto, who is an inferior not-talking dog.
Stand By Me really laid out a thesis about this whole thing, I think. Who is our Kingdom Hearts expert? I'm putting that on you, by the way.
On me? Okay.
Yes.
It's me, Katie McCarthy, features editor with US Gamer. And yeah, I'm a scholar in all things Kingdom Hearts, having been a kid that grew up with Kingdom Hearts.
Okay. That's great to have on this podcast. And we have a Kingdom Hearts bystander here as our final guest.
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and as I said at the end of watching a bunch of Kingdom Hearts primers, got it memorized!
I don't know that meme.
Really?
Who says that?
Axel says that a ton in Cage 3.
He's one of those guys with the hair, isn't he?
He has red hair.
Okay.
Spiky red hair.
You also know him as Lee.
Yeah.
They're all so different with so many different personalities. But yeah, so Kingdom Hearts 3 came out as of January. Actually, this episode will be releasing a few days after we recorded. It's a really quick turnaround.
Whoa.
So this is all going to be fresh opinions, fresh out of our brains and into your ears. But after 13 years of waiting, Kingdom Hearts 3 is out. And by the way, Kingdom Hearts 2 released the same year as Retronauts. So they're both 2006 products.
Exciting.
And we're both aging horribly. So, so we would need an entire podcast series to cover Kingdom Hearts as a whole. Like, I feel like if we did a Kingdom Hearts episode, we need multiple episodes because there are like technically nine games. So I want to split this into some light talk about the series as a whole in the first part and then talk about the sequel, the latest sequel in the second part to see how it reflects upon the series as a whole. Before we go on, though, I want to talk about our experience with Kingdom Hearts because Katie is a bit younger than us. And Kingdom Hearts has been a fun experience for me, like experiencing as an outsider the nostalgia of other people and seeing if something will fulfill that nostalgia or let them down. And it's been very fun as someone not even that much older than the people who grew up with Kingdom Hearts. I was like 20 when the first game came out. But Katie, like, when did you find Kingdom Hearts and how has it affected your life?
The first Kingdom Hearts is like my first big game I played on my own. So I guess like I played like stuff on Dreamcast on my dad's on the weekends, but like Kingdom Hearts is the first game that I played at home alone, and it was like the first like RPG I got really into. So, and I was probably like 11 or 12 when it came out, so I'm like 26 now. I don't know math. But my mom was really into Final Fantasy when in the 90s when I was growing up, and I watched her play those. So she got that game for me thinking like, oh, it's Final Fantasy characters and also Disney because you're a kid and you love Disney or whatever. And I got really into it.
And so following it through the entire series, you've played every game? Have you?
There's a few I haven't played. Like, I haven't played Chain of Memories, which is the Game Boy one. It was
Why
later.
Bother?
Yeah, yeah, it's like a card game. I've watched videos of it. And I know the story that happens in it, but I've never played that game. I didn't play the mobile game, which is like
Colid.
Key. Cross. There's like a lot of.
Oh, did you play Coded?
Well, there's Coded.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Coded. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's too many mobile games.
There's so many. Oh, my God. Yeah, I've played most of them, though. Like, I played 3DS one, PSP one, the weird, like, fragmentary passage.
So I think out of all of us, you probably have played the most.
I probably have played the most, yeah.
We're going to rely on that knowledge. Henry, how about you? What's your experience?
Oh, well, I'm the same age as you, Bob. And
103.
And so I was in my 20s when the first one came out, and I liked it conceptually, you know, of like this crazy thing that like Disney of all companies is working with Square of all companies. It just sounded so odd to me. And then I really got into the first one just for the production values. I was like, no game had looked like this or had all these voices in it. It just felt like such a prestige title. I really got into it. Then by the time the side games came out, as the first side games like Chain of Memories and Into Two, that's when it hit me that how incredibly anime-style convoluted it was. And based on my age, I was like, I've kind of been on this merry-go-round before with convoluted anime stuff. I'm not as into this now. I would still visit in on it because I still love the production design of it and just the a lot of concepts of it and the music. But I didn't watch it that closely. And then once 3 got announced, I just wanted to play it and experience it just to go to the end of this road, even though it's not the end at all.
But nope. And at least to a longer, more complicated road, if anything.
Meanwhile, my husband is he's in his late 20s, closer in age to the main audience, and like I do get to experience it through him. Like he showed me today how he memorized the like final conversation between Ansem,
Ansem, Seeker of Darkness?
The villain of Kingdom Hearts 1, voiced by Billy Zane, and Sora, how he's like, you are born in darkness and ultimately return. But he knew all the lines to it. Like, he is the audience, not me. Though
I'm catching on. I had a similar, like, this came out when I was 20, and I was a big Square fan, and I was there for the production values and for the sheer novelty, because it would just seem so weird. And I was willing to tolerate some bad gameplay just for the sheer novelty value of that. And I did play the second game, and that's where the series really lost me. There were some interesting decisions made at that point, but they really lost me with that game because I think they were focusing less on Disney and more on, like, what if we had all of our own characters in case we lose the license for Disney characters? We'll talk more about that later, but Jeremy, how about you? You're the elder in the room.
Yeah, so back in '02, Yeah, when Kingdom Hearts was first announced, the idea was so bizarre. Like Henry said, Final Fantasy meets Walt Disney. I feel like everyone I knew online was basically, you know, instantly rejected it out of hand. And I said, this is so weird. I don't see how this is going to work. I love it. I just love it. And then the game came out and I realized I don't love it. It's I just don't enjoy playing it in any way. It is kind of the quintessence of bad 3D platforming and kind of busy work minigames, and the battles areas are just like the definitive, here is a big empty box where you fight the same three enemies over and over again. I didn't enjoy it at the time, and I still don't enjoy it. When the first game came out, the girl I was dating at the time really got into it. So I saw like most of the game, but I didn't have to play it myself. And I feel like that was probably the way to experience it. But because, you know, then I got into the games press a couple of years later, and as the guy who was like, oh, he covers Japanese stuff. Oh, he covers role-playing games. Guess who got to cover the Kingdom Hearts games over and over again, especially at events. So I've played almost all the Kingdom Hearts games except 3. I haven't had a chance to play that yet. But I didn't play them a lot, but, you know, I would play them, like, at events. I've played Coded. I played it, like, on an original Japanese cell phone, for God's sake. Chain of Memories at E3, trying to figure out what the hell is happening while E3 is happening all around me. I've played pretty much all of them in some capacity. I imported 2 along with didn't have that. I think Kingdom Hearts 2 had the Final Fantasy 12 demo in it or something like that in Japan.
Yeah, in America, Dragon Quest did, but maybe it was different in Japan.
I think it was different in Japan. I think that's why I imported it. And did a lot of import coverage of the Final Fantasy XII demo. But I also played – it might have been two separate things that happened in close conjunction. But I played, you know, through the opening chapter of Kingdom Hearts 2 in Japanese, and I was like, who is Rock Sauce? What is Rock Sauce? How do you make sauce out of rocks? It's so weird. What is happening in this game? Why are they sitting around just like talking on a clock and eating ice cream? What is going on?
That sea salt ice cream looks good though.
It turns out that if you played in English, it also makes equally little sense. So I felt a little better. I felt a little less confused, adrift.
I guess it's okay to like Kingdom Hearts, by the way, if you're listening. I don't want anyone to get mad. But
we have different opinions
in the room.
To me, you know, kind of like what Henry said, you know, Kingdom Hearts is this outsider experience for me. I cannot connect with it in any way. It is these things that I enjoy, and then they come together in a way that I don't enjoy at all. Mm. But I don't you know, resent or think less of someone who likes Kingdom Hearts. Like, I totally get, you know, especially, you know, for someone who's like 10 years younger than me, 15 years younger than me, like coming into it and being at that age where you're like, oh, this is exactly what I need. That's great. That's awesome. I'm happy that it has fans, and I just please don't think less of me for not wanting to experience Donald Duck this way. Although I will say, oh my God, Donald Duck in Japanese is amazing.
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
Well, that's a good Donald Duck. I can't actually form words. Like, he can actually say "Ohayo gozaimasu" in Japanese with that voice.
Wow,
I
cannot do that.
I mean, like, I feel like the Donald Duck voice actor for English is getting a little too old. It's sounding very tortured, especially. So I tweeted about this. It got a lot of reception. But I think the worst thing Donald Duck can say in the game is Organization 13. When they make Donald Duck say that with his duck lisp, I can feel the voice actor dying. Like, please don't make me do this anymore.
What about – this looks like a good spot to search for ingredients.
Oh, yes. My God. That's
slow
so
that
annoying.
Down by like 20 times and you'll have that sentence. That's Donald Duck's catchphrase in that game. So essentially, this is how it started. It's kind of different now, but I think at its core, this is what it is. It's basically a way to play through truncated versions of your favorite Disney movies, and all of that is held together with a thick glue of JRPG and anime tropes. So the essential experience is you replaying these smaller versions of Disney movies, interactive versions of them with RPG elements, and then to stitch all that together, there is a very anime JRPG story with new characters. That's essentially what it is as a whole. But it's morphed a lot since then. I think Square, again, is more interested in their own characters than having to do Disney things, but we'll talk more about that later. But let's talk about the mastermind of Kingdom Hearts, and he's come up a million times on Retronauts. I don't know if you've ever really deep dive into his career or him as a person. And I will say he's been a pretty big punching bag throughout the history of my history with the games press because he's a guy who can't seem to get things done. But he did get Kingdom Hearts 3 done, so that's an achievement for him. But Tetsuya Nomura.
And he did pass off Final Fantasy Versus 13 to Hajime Tabata, which is also
that's
an
right.
accomplishment.
And I guess he seems pretty salty about it.
Ooh, I got stuff to say about that later.
I want to know about this. Yep. But so Nomura, just a quick bio on him. He really rose to power at Square in the late 90s as the character designer of games like Final Fantasy 7, 8, and 10. And also he was sort of their guy for just side games like Parasite Eve, Brave Fencer Musashi, Ear Guys, and The Bouncer. He sort of defined the look of Square games in the late 90s and early 2000s. Definitely, if you saw a Square game, he would normally be the lead on the art or defining what the characters looked like.
Yeah, he was very much their PlayStation 1 artist because his very angular sort of Akira Toriyama-inspired art style translated really well to the limited low-poly models of mm-hmm. PS1 games. I mean, he did the little Popeye people for Final Fantasy VII and then the lankier characters with their shooting swords for Final Fantasy VIII.
His asymmetric steampunk worked beautifully for it, though I think it's key to point out here that he is a designer of cool characters, not the guy who was writing scenarios. He was not the plot writer of these games.
Right. He would have influence on some games' stories, but not for the most part, he was just an artist. But let's talk about his early life. So he was born, I believe, in the early 70s, and he took an interest in gaming that his family actually encouraged. Whenever we hear about these guys, their families always say, no, you should be a doctor, you should be a lawyer, you should be this. His family encouraged him to pursue gaming. He programmed games, very simple games. He loved things like Dragon Quest. And his original ambition was to become a manga artist, but that is a very hard career path to take. So he chose a much more practical path and decided to be a commercial illustrator for, you know, ads and magazines and things like that.
Yeah, to be a manga artist or, you know, a comic artist, you need to be able to you know, visually tell stories. And I don't know that Nomura is necessarily good at doing that.
Yeah.
And I say this as someone who studied to be an artist and is also like would love to be a comics artist but am not good at telling stories visually. So I kind of do the Nomura thing, which is like, here's some people standing around in a scene. Please do not ask me to draw people having like a dialogue together or living a slice of life experience.
Yeah, he's more of a like a fashion artist because all the art I see of him is like, here's a character posed in clothing. Like at most they'll be leaning against something, but most of the time they'll just be in a void.
Yeah, I feel like Parasite Eve key art is sort of like is Nomura in his purest form. Like there are illustrations of Aya Brea like you know, posing and like putting her leg up and stuff like she's, you know, leaning against a chair or something, but there's not actually a chair there. It's just like she's in this pose in a white nothingness. So yeah, that's kind of the style he works in.
Chairs are hard to draw. That's what I'll say.
They are. is it like an office chair? Is it a desk chair?
You can draw on your own chair.
Stool.
You figure it out. Use your imagination.
It's very fashion model type poses.
For like, sure. Yeah. So he began at Square with Final Fantasy IV, very at the bottom rung there as a debugger of the game. So he was at Square very early. In fact, he's been there for almost like 30 years now, which is crazy. He started designing things art-wise for Final Fantasy V, where he designed monsters. So he was out there designing very Amano-style monsters for the game. That's where he first tapped into his art abilities for Square. And actually, he wanted to work at Square because he was looking for a job, and he saw a Square ad looking for employees, but it had a mono art on it. Maybe like, who knows, like something from Final Fantasy 3 or 2 or something like that. But that's what drew him to Square. Like, I want to work for a company that does this sort of thing. Like, this kind of art really speaks to me. And he considers Amano one of his major influences, which is weird because I don't see that at all.
Yeah, no.
And he kind of did replace him, too.
He did, yeah.
So during the development of Final Fantasies of this era, typically staff members, the teams were pretty small, especially compared to today. So Sakaguchi would have his teams bring him, you know, their ideas in the form of like a document, like give me all your ideas for what you want in this game. And staff members would typically, you know, write them all out on a computer and print them out and give them to Sakaguchi. But Nomura for Final Fantasy VI, I believe, he basically made like a handwritten thing with like illustrations and diagrams and designs. Like, he really wowed Sakaguchi. And that's basically how he climbed the ladder at Square, by going above and beyond what was required of him. Like, he showed an early flair. He really stood out. And that's how he became the graphic designer of Final Fantasy VI. And that's the first game where he had input on story. I believe he created the characters of Shadow and Setzer and their backstories. So
those are such Nomura types.
They really are, yeah.
And that's why those are the only Final Fantasy VI characters that show up in stuff that he does.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're right, yeah.
Well, Hironobu Sakaguchi is a really, interesting figure for him. And, like, I mean, Katie, like, Ericus is – the character of Ericus in the world of Kingdom Hearts is a total tribute to Sakaguchi and his importance to just Square and its whole history too, right?
Probably. I mean, I feel like something in Kingdom Hearts is that the characters – or Ericus is very looks Japanese, you know, compared to, like, all the big-eyed, you know, other characters in the world. So I can definitely see that as being a very – and he's like a mentor type figure too.
And
so
he's
like
got the Sakaguchi mustache.
Oh yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
I love that mustache. Yeah.
Ericus is a Square spelled differently.
That's a good.
They're too clever with those names in Kingdom Hearts. But yeah, let's go. Final Fantasy VI was his first like major role. He designed monsters for V, VI. He was the graphic director, directing how the game looked. And really, like I said before, his salad days were 97 to 2002, where he was on almost every main Final Fantasy outside of 9, which was more of a throwback to older games, the older Famicom games, very different than the Nomura style. And Kingdom Hearts in 2002 was the first game he directed, and he's only directed Kingdom Hearts games since then in terms of games that were actually released. So not Final Fantasy Versus 13. But apparently he is now directing the Final Fantasy VII Remake after it was taken away from CyberConnect 2, I believe. So,
well, I think he was always directing it. I think he was just overseeing CyberConnect 2.
Okay. I think now he's even more in control, though, because Kingdom Hearts 3 is over and the development now is internally at Square. So I think he's even in a major role there now. But that is technically the next game he is making, although that is going to be the next Kingdom Hearts 3 for Square, I think. Who knows when that will be coming out. I think there's been like one mock-up screenshot to date in a, like a logo probably.
There is a gameplay demo.
Was there a gameplay
like
demo?
A few years ago.
No wonder
I
think
forgot. That was a CyberConnect 2 demo.
Yeah, so yeah, that probably got thrown in the trash. Definitely. But
but I mean, they've shown off like, you know, renders of the characters. So there's
I've seen
something
like
exists.
Some sort of art for the game. But yeah, we don't know when it's coming out apparently.
It's not a real game.
Yeah.
Barrett and Tifa look pretty cool.
It's a fun idea for a game.
If it plays like Kingdom Hearts, it can't be. It can't retell the story of Final Fantasy because it's too big, like or FF7. Like.
I'm okay with it being an action RPG. I don't want it to play Kingdom Hearts. But let's move on to the background of Kingdom Hearts. I think this is very interesting because Henry and I do a lot of animation history research for our What a Cartoon podcast and for our Talking Simpsons Network podcast. And looking at where Disney was in the early 2000s and late 90s when these deals were signed, you can see why Disney would want to do this. So back then, so now we're in 2019. As of this recording, the whole Fox thing just happened. If you go on Disney's front page, the Disney company, you'll see Bart Simpson there with what, like Avatar and other things
Deadpool.
Like that? Yeah, like Disney owns everything.
John McClane, the Xenomorph, they got it all.
I mean, the joke like, oh, can X be in Kingdom Hearts? Those are no longer funny because everything can be in Kingdom Hearts now. But back in the early 2000s.
Except Star Trek. Don't own Star Trek yet.
Oh, give it time.
Or the DC Universe, so no Batman.
Give it time. That's what I'm saying. but almost 20 years ago, they were not doing so well. I'm sure they were still making so much money, but they were not making all the money. So if you look at the different parts of their business, parks-wise, California Adventure just started. Nobody liked that. Nobody wanted the theme park version of California. Their movies were all underperforming, things like Atlantis. I believe Treasure Planet was around that time. Even things like Hercules and Mulan were not being the big hits like Lion King and Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast. They were kind of in a slump. And ultimately, Disney wants everyone to be their audience. And they mainly wanted men, young men, because they were the audience they really couldn't pin down because, you know, little boys could like the musicals, but then they'd eventually grow out of them or be told, like, you're not supposed to like that. You know, they were very much gendered products. And it should be pointed out that the same year Kingdom Hearts released was the same year Disney turned around in terms of their animation. So that's when Lilo and Stitch came out. So that they recovered the same year Kingdom Hearts came out. But in that like on a 3 or 4 year period, they really needed more support. And I think that is the only time this deal could have been signed for Disney in that period of time. The weird Bob Iger apocalypse. Where everything was going wrong.
Well, they're just in the they're in such a search for something too. It's why they rebooted Tron because they're like, "Would you get Tron? What if we did Tron? You'll come back for that." They didn't know what they wanted to be. So teaming up with, I mean, too, Disney stuff is, I mean, it's huge here, but also in Japan, they love Disney stuff.
Yes.
So you go to a Japanese company for that is a really smart move.
So a huge cross-cultural appeal. Also, another contextual thing for this period in time, we all forget this probably, but at this time, Square was poised to be the next entertainment monolith on par with Disney. Like, they're going to be making movies. Their games are huge.
They're doing animation for the Matrix spinoff.
Oh, that's right. Animatrix, too. Yeah, prior to the Spirits Within flopping, that was what Square was poised to be. Things didn't work out so well for them. They still did very good after that, but they were cut down before they could reach that level. And Disney probably wanted to be in bed with them. Like, this could be the next big company we want in bed with us. We want them on our side for when they reach their heights. We want to be working with them. So, like, all these things happening at once, I feel like, are why Kingdom Hearts was allowed to happen. Outside of that context, I really don't think it could have ever happened. And I wonder how long that deal was good for, because I feel like Disney, We'll talk more about 3 after the break, but I feel like Disney is now more aware of what Kingdom Hearts is doing than ever before, and it feels even more restrictive and even more the parts of the game that are Kingdom Hearts feel like they're so isolated from the parts that are Disney
right.
stuff.
I heard that the Frozen stuff is like yeah. super
– Yes.
Just like you know like – like that Lord of the Rings RPG that EA made where it's like, hey, here's all these guys who are kind of like the Lord of the Rings characters from the movies having an adventure right next to the yeah. people in the movie but not actually taking part. Yeah, that's cool, right?
In most of the Kingdom Hearts retellings, it's like, oh, so maybe Sora was in this scene with Donald and Goofy. With Frozen, it's just like, hey, look at that song she's singing over the hill. It's just
so
like they're
funny.
Always like in the background.
Well, there's this hilarious out-of-context official Kingdom Hearts manga panel of Donald explaining it. He's like, no, chaos, I forget how he puts it, but it's order and chaos and you can't disturb these worlds too much. Like that's,
it's like the prime directive of the Kingdom Hearts team.
And Donald explains it to you right on that panel.
Would Donald say general order number one?
Donald talks like he should never talk. I want to hear that voice actor say that dialogue bubble that I never believe is real, but it is real. So how this happened was so some Square higher-ups around the time of Mario 64, they wanted to make a 3D game with the same degree of movement as Mario 64, but they were like, we don't have any characters to push this game. We make so many Final Fantasies, there's no like one standout Final Fantasy character. It was probably before 7. And I believe Nomura overheard this. This is the apocryphal story. I'm sure it was much more business-like, but apparently Nomura overheard this conversation or this meeting, and he said, I want to direct this game. I want to lead this game. I want it to be about my character that I create, and we should get Disney involved because Disney has very popular characters. We will never have a character as popular as Mario or Disney characters. So that is basically where this came into being. Interestingly, according to my research, Square was working in the same building as Disney at some point during their history. So their executives would have lunch together occasionally, and they were like – they had connections previously, so that's how they were able to talk to each other.
I mean, it was probably like a Disney auxiliary office, you know, not like their main headquarters in Japan or something, but
– like a licensing office or something
yeah,
like
something
that.
Yeah, something along those lines. I mean, they did used to work in this – Square used to work in this big building in Shinjuku, really close to the station. And
yeah.
Yeah, I could see, you know, that being an office complex where they had, you know, like – a Disney office with 20 people in it and, yeah, get the conversation rolling.
It's a nice office. It's a nice office park. I'm just bragging that I've been there.
I've been there, too. I've been inside of it. But, I mean,
That's the new one, Bob, not the old one.
Oh, God. The new one's great, though.
Is that
new
that, like, weird-looking building? I think I walked
yeah, it's
by
got, like,
when
it's
I was got, in
Tokyo. The yeah. windows are all misshapen.
It looked cool when I walked by it when I was in Tokyo.
Yeah, but I look at it and I'm like, I feel so bad for the window washers. That's got to be
yeah.
– it's like it doesn't observe normal human geometry. It's like, you know, non-Euclidean space or something.
Yeah.
This feels name-droppy, but the best, cheapest sushi I've had is in their office park.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's so good.
It's really good.
Get it if you're there. And also, you can't meet Hajime Tabata anymore. He's gone.
No,
I did.
Very sad.
And then drop a name right there in your face.
You can go to their cafe and hear them play the final dungeon music for Final Fantasy VIII on infinite loop
yes.
over and over again until workers, you're like, when do I get to fight Ultimecia?
The workers have gone insane weeks ago.
I got to have slime pancakes there. Regular pancakes cut into the shape of a slime.
I got to walk into the showroom and Sephiroth looked up my skirt.
But yeah, I wanted to point out that like that is why I mean we just see Disney as like the thing that the company that owns everything. And they did own a lot of things in that time period, but they were looking for to diversify their audience, and Kingdom Hearts was part of that for sure. So I want to talk about the generalities of Kingdom Hearts before we move on to 3 after the break. So Kingdom Hearts stuff in general, so Katie, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but from my account, there are 9 games.
There might be 10.
I think like one game is like a reworking of another game, like a cell phone
there's
game.
Like, there's a couple. There's
recoded.
But there's also a re-chain of memories.
Yeah. I like counting like just like the bit. Yeah, like I would count chain of memories and re-chain as like the same game. It's just basically a port that looks better and it plays better. But I don't know. So there's like, I'm going to try and do this off the top of my head.
Here we go. Here
so there's go. First Kingdom Hearts, there's Chain of Memories, there's Kingdom Hearts 2. Mm-hmm. And then
I'm done after that.
Yeah, and then it goes to 3, 5, 8 over 2
nice.
Days.
Nice.
God, what was okay? What's after that? It might be Coded after that.
And then maybe. Birth by Sleep.
Birth by Sleep. Mm-hmm. Oh man, there might be less than okay.
Dream Drop Distance.
Dream Drop Distance is the 3DS one. There's Key or is Kingdom Hearts Key? It's like a lower X thing. They pronounce it cross, but also it's supposed to be pronounced key in the context of the game. It doesn't make any sense.
Is that the smartphone
That's
game?
That's the smartphone game. Okay. It's also a browser game.
Key,
yeah.
Like the Greek letter.
Yeah. There's one I'm forgetting. Oh, there's a Fragmentary Passage, which shipped with Kingdom Hearts 2.5.
That's like a
final
Kingdom
remix.
Hearts 0.2 Birth by Sleep, a fragmentary passage.
Yeah, it's like a, no it's one like a 3 hour game.
Ever let Nomura near the title of a game.
There's like a bunch of tildes in that name too. It's great.
I've turned around on this. I think it's kind of awesome how alienating these games are to outsiders, and they succeed despite that. Especially, we'll talk about 3, but 3 does not care if you don't know anything. Yeah. It's not going to explain anything to you. And I like how just brazen all of this naming is. It really fits in line with the philosophy of these games. Like, we don't care if you don't get this. Like, this is for Kingdom Hearts fans only. But most games feature the trio of Sora, who's sort of like the human Mickey stand-in, Donald Duck and Goofy, in an action RPG context, sort of like Secret of Mana, if you want to throw it back to that. I always think of Secret of Mana when I think of Kingdom Hearts. I don't know if that's wrong, but it feels like the next generation of Secret of Mana, to me at least.
That's why we haven't had any Mana games.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than any of the actual next generation of Secret of Mana
true.
Games.
Yeah, even if you don't like Kingdom Hearts, it's better than Dawn of Mana, which, a great soundtrack on that game, by the way, but wasted on a bad game. But each
I'll go to bat for Children of Mana, but that's it.
That's a great one. I do like that one. But so each Disney World you visit in these Kingdom Hearts games, they usually feature like a guest character that will assist you in battle, although you can't bring them to other worlds because, as I've known from people who worked on Disney stuff, they don't like different realities interacting. When we had Nina Matsumoto on our podcast talking about the Disney Afternoon collection, she wasn't allowed to have the characters interacting with each other. They'd be like in separate windows looking in different directions on the cover of that
game. I did the cover art for that episode last week.
They were all like,
I put them all in the same physical space.
Don't let Disney find out
Chip
about
that. Chip and Dale were standing right at Scrooge McDuck's feet, looking up at amazement in him having a VGA 100 rated copy of DuckTales 2 for NES because he's rich.
The licensors would disapprove of that. Misuse of the characters.
That's why Mickey, Donald, Goofy, those type of mega characters who get to walk around the parks everywhere, they can break the rules in KH, but everybody else has to stay in their lane, like very, very sectioned off.
Where do the three Caballeros fit in here?
Oh, man, I'd love them.
They'd be in Caballero world. They'd be in their own, like, South America, Central and South America world. Mm. That Donald would then transform into his Caballero self for that.
They don't make Kingdom Hearts worlds out of those weird Disney compilation movies.
They ought to.
The Make Mine Music world.
Right, yeah. Get yourself a Song of the South world.
I would play that. That's awesome.
Yeah,
that would be a driving game, yeah.
Donald would turn into a version of himself in the film like Mickey, Donald, and Goofy did when they went to the Three Musketeers world.
Yeah.
I like that.
But, I mean, with those kind of restrictive rules, you can see why it takes 12 years to put out a fucking Kingdom Hearts game.
Oh, we'll get to that. So this series started on the PS2, but it was very – it just jumped from platform to platform, usually on portables. So everything, like Katie said, like Game Boy Advance, cell phones, smartphones, DS, 3DS, PSP – though the next big console release always seemed like it was just around the corner. Like everyone, even though the other games were quote-unquote real Kingdom Hearts games, everyone was waiting for 3 or whatever the next console game would be. And these are all playable via 2 collections on current systems.
There's also The Story So Far, which has everything.
So you can get them both together.
I think there's some games that are just a big cutscene.
I mean,
because
they're
like,
yeah.
You don't need to play this, you know?
Yeah.
Like Coded or something? They turn
I think
into
Coded
a cutscene?
Is like just a big cutscene.
I thought so.
Because Coded is like almost like a puzzle action game or something. Yeah. It was like Intelligent Cube meets Kingdom Hearts. It was
Same with 358. Like, it was a DS game.
I think you mean 358 over 2.
It was a DS game, and you can't put that really on
Solve
a PS3.
For X.
So they instead just, I believe they just HDified the cutscenes and stitched it together as best they could. But I always wondered, with the proliferation on so many different systems, if that was because Kingdom Hearts was the biggest hit Square had at a time of dire financial situation where they had to merge with Enix, and that's why they're like, we need every Kingdom Hearts game on every system we possibly can.
And at a time when Japan was getting used to HD development, and it was like the narrative was, oh, Japan can't make games anymore, and they're only making games for portable systems now. Of course, that's reversed. All the biggest games are Japanese and on modern systems now, but back then that definitely wasn't the case.
Well, and when Chain of Memories came out, it was when Square really wanted to be on the GBA. Like, they didn't give a shit about being on the GameCube. They wanted to be on the GBA.
Yeah, they made good with there. Nintendo to do that in 2003.
I mean, they did give us Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles on GameCube, but really their heart was on GBA.
There's a remake of that coming out now.
There
right?
is.
Yes, on Switch, finally.
And Chocobo Mystery Dungeon, everybody just came out, and I can't wait to go download.
Is that a version of the Wii game?
Yes.
The Wii game
I
is
love
so
that
good.
Game. Everybody. Yeah.
Everybody. Isn't that great?
It's so cute.
I love Mystery Dungeon games, and I love chocobos, and I love buddies. So what could possibly go wrong?
So I want to contain this into maybe like 10 minutes, but the story of Kingdom Hearts.
Oh, no.
We're all laughing.
No.
I will say up front,
we have another podcast session in an hour.
It's true. Now. And I have to like eat again and go to sleep. But I will say, like, my opinion is, like, I like convoluted stories, but like Henry said, I grew out of them. If you – talking about Kingdom Hearts up front would be no different than if we were talking about, like, Evangelion to an outsider. Like, but I feel like playing Kingdom Hearts 3 is like watching the Evangelion movie without seeing the TV show. Just like, who are all these people? What are they doing? What's the context?
I feel like the Kingdom Hearts series' biggest crime is that Kingdom Hearts 3 took so long to come out.
Yeah.
So you have something like 6 or 7 games that are literally just them spinning their wheels narratively and not actually accomplishing anything and just trying to say, like, where is there a gap that we can squeeze some sort of story into?
It's sort
and
of
so
like
you end up with like this endless iteration of the key people.
I was telling Henry like via Twitter or whatever that it was sort of I think it's a little pretentious for me to say this, but it feels like Arabian Nights, where the woman has to tell a new story every night to avoid being killed. That's like Nomura to avoid having his job murdered. Like keep stretching the story, keep expanding. And that's essentially what it is. Because so my take on it was like, it's like the result of precarious IP negotiation and just like his inability to finish a game. So like the story has changed as the result of just so many different factors, and it's moved in so many different ways. And Henry recommended this this great video, which I'll link to, one of many on the internet. Like, here is the most abbreviated summary of Kingdom Hearts' story, and it's still 40 minutes long. But from the very beginning, there are so many proper nouns and so many different versions of characters that I was just like Teflon. It was just hitting me and like bouncing off of me. Like, even with that descriptor, I had no idea like what was going on. Like I said earlier in the series, from the second game, I feel like Square and Nomura wanted to build a safety net where it was like, in case Disney says no, we have so many characters we can tell these stories about. And from 3, I feel like I played 3. The Disney stuff feels like something they're getting out of the way. Like, okay, we'll get through this stuff, and then we'll feature all the characters you like and all their endings and all their stories and stuff like that. But now it's oddly enough, like, to me, playing through these games, the Disney thing feels like a formality. Like, we have to do Disney stuff, so just play through these, but then you're going to get to the stuff you actually care about, because the Disney worlds don't have any real effect on the story. Like, at best, a MacGuffin will be in that world, and that'll be it. But Katie and Henry, help me with the story. What's happening, and do you like it?
I consider myself a Kingdom Hearts fan, having grown up with it, and I consider, like, the first game one of my favorite games. But I remember playing 2 and not liking 2. 2 I only played once, so it's been, like, over 15 years, I guess, at this point since I played Kingdom Hearts 2. And then I like Birth by Sleep a lot, and there's, like, a few of the other ones. Like, the 3DS one's pretty bad. But what I like about – or what I used to like about the first game was that it was a pretty simple story. Like, you could comprehend it really easily. It's just about friendship and, like,
the loss of friendship,
you know, and dealing with that and, like, the grief of
growing
like, kids.
Up.
Yeah, yeah and growing up.
Yeah.
And I feel like as the series has gone on, that has definitely gotten way more complicated. But I feel like that's still kind of the core. And I think in Kingdom Hearts 3, it's kind of comes back to – like – there's still a lot of complicated fluff and really dumb shit, but it's it's still about, like, you know, friendship and also humanity and, like, what that means, which I feel like the game is – or the series has – evolve more towards with Kingdom Hearts 2 dealing with, like, nobodies, which are, like, clones or people or whatever.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think that, yeah, the plot should be so simple. It really is there in one of, like, it's really about so many different just, like, trios of people interacting with each other. And, you know, sometimes you bounce off each other. Sometimes you don't. You enjoy each other. And it's about connections with hearts. And it's also that, like, Sora is such a – just a innocent, lovely kid. It's
where
hard
are his
not
parents?
To like
where are Sora's parents?
They do exist.
They're in the first game.
Yeah, that's like the first game established. They go to the island, you know, to have fun, and there are like parents that exist. And then after that, just like he doesn't have parents anymore.
Yeah, his parents disappear.
And but yeah, the way it gets worse and worse. I think something too that makes it convoluted is it is that like they just had to keep punting. Like it was like, well, three hasn't been negotiated yet. We got to punt again. We got to keep exploring this thing. Somebody else.
More amnesia. More amnesia. Go.
So much amnesia. Yeah. So many doubles. So many digital doubles. So many.
Digital doubles. It's true.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard Goofy talk about data.
And also a thing that makes it take forever is that. Oh, also about the story that how little the Disney stuff matters. In the many videos of retrospectives I watched of like explaining the story. Almost no scenes from any Disney World are in there because nothing that matters happens in them.
And yeah, at most they'll be like, you'll get done with the Disney World and then the villains will show up like, they're moving on to the next Disney World. And then they'll have some lore exchange and then that's it.
Well, and Nomura also is like, he is a reverse weeb. Like he loves,
reverse weeb.
He really is into Star Wars. He's into Star Trek. He's into Lord of the Rings type stuff. Especially Ericus, who we mentioned earlier, like Birth by Sleep is just a Star Wars prequel. It's about the fall of the Jedi Order to Xehanort, who is basically a Palpatine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. So Organization 13 is like, they're like Jedis.
Yep. Yeah.
I thought so.
Well, they're more Sith.
They're more like Siths. Yeah. But there's 13 of them instead of the rule of two.
And a Sith only speaks in absolutes, Bob. You need to keep that in mind.
I don't like any of this conversation.
So when you have stories like that, like that's him – you're adding the complications of Star Wars to that, but that's also something really cool that he puts in that, like, characters like Ericus, voiced by Mark Hamill, and then you also had Ansem the Wise was once voiced by Christopher Lee, and same
we
with
had Leonard Nimoy in this game,
Xehanort too. Was Leonard Nimoy. It was perfect. He had Ericus and Xehanort were fighting each other, and it was Luke Skywalker fighting Spock, but the fucking things take so long
this.
That everybody dies before he can make them.
He was good as Xehanort too. Like he had that perfect, really like creepy voice. You know.
Oh God, it's. I mean, Rutger Hauer plays him in the new game, and he's also very good.
Yeah, he's pretty good. Yeah,
but there's no replacing Spock. You can't replace Spock.
What I like about the series, though, is that this sounds like a weird compliment, but again, I like how it doesn't care if you're on the outside. It's very much about we made this very expensive thing. And only this amount of people will actually be able to engage with it on the level it's intended to be engaged with. I found it interesting that if you go to the summaries page in your little like gummy phone or whatever where it's like chapter one and it gives you like a paragraph of what happened, I would read those and be like, that's what happened in this chapter? This is very concise. Like nothing what these people were saying conveyed this information. Like so I feel like in terms of like the abstract of the story, it does make sense, but the communication of that story is not done as well as like here's what's happening in the scene on paper, and then the acting and the dialogue does not convey that very well.
This is a Squaresoft or Square Enix, I guess,
yes.
problem. I mean, Final Fantasy 13, there was so much just like you didn't get in the game, and then you would read the database codex or whatever and be like, oh, huh. I guess it would have been good to have known like what the cosmology of this universe is and what the big floating broken moon thing in the sky is and what the role of the goddesses
is.
Had to do. Yeah, but they didn't actually explain that in the game. They're just like, whoa, I got a Lassie mark. Let's go like have an adventure on the road and just keep walking in the straight line for a long time.
Wait, slow down.
And also the major complication in KH is that I think he can only create so many characters, and so every character has to have like a double or an echo of yourself or separate identities. Like Riku, I think, has at least three other Rikus.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Not to be mistaken for the other Riku.
Yeah, well,
it was also in there.
I mean, it all. I feel like it all began in KH2 is where this all got this
it's,
so complicated.
Yeah, it's where it went weird.
It's opening.
Where, it's where you meet Roxas, and you meet Roxas, and then you, and then when Mickey tells you that's not Ansem, you're like, what the fuck is it? And so you have to constantly say, Ansem, bringer of darkness, or Ansem the Wise. Like, that's the you. Otherwise, people
and
won't know
the Wise
Ansem.
Is like a good guy, yep. But you don't know that till like the end. There's just like so much going on.
They also got rid of some of the catnip I liked in this game. For me personally, was the Final Fantasy characters, and I guess there is a story reason why they're not in the third game. But it never made sense to me from a just a. I guess sales reason or just a way to attract people to the series. Like, I felt like that was always a major factor. Like, you'll meet Aerith, you'll meet Waka, there's Moogles and Chocobos, but now it's like a Moogle sells you things and that's it. Like, I don't know why. Maybe it's Nomura trying to take more ownership over the whole thing. Like, these are only my characters in this game now.
Yeah, it's really weird. I think you said in the interview, like, before Kingdom Hearts 3 came out that since Kingdom Hearts has such a well-established, like, original character base, they don't need the Final Fantasy games or Final Fantasy characters, like, lean on anymore. But it doesn't really make sense because they're, like, a pretty integral part to the Kingdom Hearts series. Yeah, like, you know, like, Leon / Squall is, like, a pretty big part of it and everything.
Yeah, the whole core appeal, the original pitch of this was Final Fantasy meets Disney. So you took away the Final Fantasy and
it's, like, just Disney and also the spiky-haired Nomura characters.
I think it's, like, now the series is old enough that people are now nostalgic for it, for sure. I mean, that's what we're talking about today. And so, like, in Kingdom Hearts, when Kingdom Hearts 2 came out, Final Fantasy 7 was, I don't know, 5 years old, yeah. 6 was like 8 years old, and we were seeing characters from that series. Now if you see a character from 2, that's a 13-year-old character. People are now nostalgic for Roxas. Gross. And other people like that. I mean, it's weird how nostalgia works like that, especially if you're not part of it. Before we go to our break and then talk about the third game in detail, I want to shout out Yoko Shimomura. So she had done lots of stuff for Square before this, including the Mario RPG soundtrack, which is so good. People are too mean to that game, and I will not stand for it. But I will say this was her major breakout role for a blockbuster game, Kingdom Hearts. Although she does a lot of interpretations of Disney music, her original stuff in this game is great. And now I think that she is like the music director for the game, so not doing a lot of the composition. But she still has a major influence on the series. But her stuff is so good. Any thoughts on Shimomura before we go to the break? I just feel like she is such a great composer and still very prolific.
I just think her music's really good. Like, I feel like one of the things I remember most about Kingdom Hearts, like, when I, like, think about Kingdom Hearts, like, the music's usually the first thing come to mind. Like, the music of, like, Hall of Bastion or just, like, the loading screen music, which kind of, like, changes incrementally from game to game. Like, she's really good at, like, making really memorable melodies, I guess, and also making Disney music her own.
Mm. She's also really good at adopting a lot of different styles and not leaning on the same sort of musical concepts. I mean, there's been a lot of composers that Square Enix or Squaresoft has hired through the years and, you know, employed, and they created great music. But if you look at someone like, you know, Nobuo Uematsu, like, every Final Fantasy soundtrack has kind of like the same cadences. Like, you can always tell it's the airship theme because it always kind of sounds the same. You know, Yasunori Mitsuda is pretty much everything is going to sound kind of Gaelic. you know, Masashi Hamauzu, everything is kind of like that sort of echoey concert hall piano style with strings. And it's all great and I love it. But I feel like she's the only one of their composers who has been able to just like step outside of herself and create music that really, you know, adjusts to the tone and the style of the game and isn't necessarily like you hear it and think, oh, that's Shimomura. It's more like, oh, this is the perfect music for this game. And yeah, I agree about her making Disney music her own, like turning Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo into like some sort of, you know, Final Fantasy battle theme. That's a tall order, and she did it.
I feel like they're letting them do less because I could have done without the 20-second loop of "You've Got a Friend in Me" in the Toy Story world.
Oh yeah, that was a lot.
But I don't think it's her fault. I think it's we want the music represented as it exists.
Yeah, I think. Well, Shimomura, her work is amazing on it. I think the music is the secret sauce of why everybody really loves those games and stuck with it. And especially like the also with the soundtrack, Utada Hikaru's music, like that created a whole new generation of J-pop nerds in America.
Oh yeah,
like
I listened to that in my car.
The music,
Simple and Clean.
Simple and Clean. All the songs are great, up to her new songs and this, and like Utada's entire talk about seeing how much time has passed. Like her entire life has changed incredibly since that first song she did, and that's. It's like she was born to do Kingdom Hearts because she is a celebrated J-pop star, like of second or third generation pop star in Japan, but also grew up in America. Mm-hmm. So she can make a song that can work both in American English and in Japanese and works perfectly to appeal in the same way. Like it's. That's everybody. When you're confused in the game, you're just like, boy, but I remember Simple and Clean was so great. I don't care how confusing this story point is, that song. Ooh, boy.
It's a good memories. But we'll be back after the break with more talk about Kingdom Hearts and specifically Kingdom Hearts 3. Back, and we're just going to talk about Kingdom Hearts 3 for the rest of this podcast. Ostensibly, that's what this podcast is about, so it's time to talk about it. And Katie, you were the reviewer for US Gamer for this game. We just talked about how you spend an entire weekend not sleeping, presumably eating very little, and playing lots of Kingdom Hearts 3.
Mm-hmm. I only ate like chips and salsa.
And I recommend people read your review, but can you give us your general take on the game before we start digging into it? I just want to know, like, what would your take be on Kingdom Hearts 3 after the review and after the whole process?
I will say in retrospect, I probably scored it too high. I probably would have given it a 4 out of 5 if I were to do an amendment today.
That's
I give it 4.5. That's pretty high, you know?
That's true of every game I ever reviewed.
Yeah, same.
I scored always, them all too high.
Yeah, and then I'm like, one day, like, eh, I could have gone lower, you know? Or there's like one rare instance where I'm like, oh, like Splatoon 2, I think I gave it 4 out of 5. I'm like, I should really, like, I still play that, so I probably could have given that a higher score. But, yeah, I came away really loving it, which I was honestly very apprehensive because I really don't like the 3DS One Dream Drop Distance. It's total nonsense, horrible, like, action combat.
I did review that one for 1UP back in the day. I think I gave it, like, a C or C minus.
Yeah, it's, like, so bad. That's probably one of the worst games in the series. And that's, like, the one that leads directly into 3, weirdly enough. And then... I really like Birth by Sleep a lot, and I like the first game a lot. So it's like out of the whole series, my two favorites are like from a long, long time ago. So I was like very apprehensive going into 3, but I ended up really liking it. And I think it's because I enjoyed the combat more than I ever have in the series before.
I do want to talk about that more later because I feel like I was surprised by how little changed about 3 compared to past games. I want to go over really quickly the development cycle because it was less tortured than I remembered. I remember it being a lot more tortured. It's not like Duke Nukem Forever or Resident Evil 4 or anything like that. It was pretty simple, actually. I'm sure it was much more complicated behind the scenes. But
simple
this is,
and clean?
Yes, simple and maybe not so clean. But this is what they're telling us. This is their story. I imagine there was a lot more like internal politics and fights and things like that. But so we all know that Nomura was busy working on Final Fantasy Versus 13, which would become Final Fantasy 15 over time after being given to a new director. Although I believe that it became 15 before Hajime Tabata took over. I'm pretty sure that was the case.
I thought it was simultaneous. I thought they basically like sent him over and he was working as boss behind the scenes for a couple of years before it was publicly announced.
I think, like, in my research, it said that the game became 15 before a few months before it was announced that Nomura would not be the director. So that could just be the surface level what we're telling the public thing where he was never the director or he wasn't the director for a long time.
Yeah, I think he was working – Tabata was working as the director for quite a while before it was announced.
But for a long time, Versus 13, which I believe was announced right after the release of Kingdom Hearts 2.
It was at E3 2006 yes. along with the rest of the –
Fabula,
Nova, Crystallis.
We need to do an entire podcast on that thing, whatever became of that. But yeah, so Final Fantasy Versus 13 was going to be the action RPG version of Final Fantasy 13's blah, 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 blah. We just said the word. You don't need to hear it again. But that universe, that became
FNC.
15. What's that?
FNC.
FNC. Not going to do that again. But so Nomura supposedly was working on that. No, I mean he was. But he was like upfront about it. Like, I'm too busy working on this. Kingdom Hearts will not be out until this is out. So not until after 2012, which was wishful thinking on his part because, as we know, Final Fantasy 15 did not come out until early 2017. Or was it late 2016?
2016.
It was like December. Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, he wasn't wrong. It did come out after 2012.
That part was
– It was extremely true.
Yeah, that part was very true. But so this game was formally announced at E3 2013. I believe I was in the audience – for that Sony conference.
What a Sony conference.
Yeah. What else did they announce? And I don't
remember. Well, actually, no.
That was when they announced Versus 13 is going to become 15,
yeah,
right?
Sorry.
It was like a back-to-back.
That's when Square shot themselves in the foot.
The logo change, right? That was the big moment.
Like, everyone was like, oh, my God.
And then everybody was like, well, then where's Cage 3? And then that was the next trailer right after it.
Yeah.
And there's that's where it's – Sora back on Destiny Island, and he picks up a Keyblade.
That's right.
And an old one, as would be later revealed, owned by Ericus, that was left by Aqua to leave the doorway the dark dark dimension.
How did you retain all of this? I really need to know.
I've watched a lot of videos this morning.
Okay.
Just don't ask what he had to get rid of in his memory, too. What is my husband's birthday?
Did you forget by learning all this? But E3 2013 was the first formal announcement of the game that we all assume would be happening at some point. E3 2014 was the first teaser with quote-unquote gameplay footage. In September of that year, Nomura was removed as the director of 15, Final Fantasy 15. But I believe after that gameplay teaser, Nomura like sort of apologized where he was like, we announced it too early. We're too early in the process to be showing you these things. And it was at one of the E3s. I remember being there. And they showed Kingdom Hearts 3 things, and there was like a very bad video of Nomura like in a closet somewhere recorded on an iPhone. He's like, I'm still alive. I'm still working. He holds up today's newspaper. Like, it's going to happen. Well, Kingdom Hearts 3 will happen.
I think 3 feels like it took too long because you just assumed after 2 that 3 had to come in the next few years. Mm-hmm. And every time
the next decade even.
Every time there was a new Kingdom Hearts game out, by the end of it, you're like, well, this is where they're leaving it off for when they'll pick it up in 3. And you just assumed a 3 announcement would be any day now. So that's why it really felt like it was a decade before you actually heard about the game.
And what really impacted the release of the game was it started on the Luminous Engine, which I believe all of the Fabula Nova Crystallis games were being made with, correct?
Yes, it was originally called the White Engine.
The White Engine. Is Final Fantasy 14 still running under that?
I don't remember what the movement there was. Yeah, I think 14 went from like some sort of terrible bespoke engine to the Luminous Engine.
But eventually they moved to Unreal 4, which really slowed things down. Like moving to an entirely different engine is what impacted the release of the game the most. And apparently Kingdom Hearts 3 was developed alongside 2.5 HD Remix, which taught them a lot about HD development on that level, on that scale, especially with Kingdom Hearts assets. And basically from there, it was a drip feed announcement of, you know, new worlds for like years. There'd be like every – what's that Disney called? D23 or whatever? Mm. Like for like 2 or 3 years in a row, it's like now you're going to get Big Hero 6 World. Now you're going to get Monsters, Inc. World. Like there'd just be like a drip feed of announcements until the eventual release. And I believe there were some early leaks. The game was supposed to be out in like October of 2018. I remember seeing that Monsters, Inc. Screenshots very, very early.
Oh, like, I mean the big leak happened like at the start of January or maybe the holidays.
I think it was like December. Yeah.
Though that's also why they held back the secret ending as a downloadable. They're like, well, you didn't get this secret, though, hackers who got a retail copy early via nefarious means. Apparently they chased out. They actually found the person who sold it, and they They're getting a whooping right now.
He's being disappeared. So I feel like this game fits well with Retronauts because it feels like an old game in good ways and bad. Like playing this game now in 2019, it feels like a game that was developed 15 years ago in terms of the design. Like it is a very old school, as in like early 3D game – sorry, early console 3D game mindset. And that so very much like the other Kingdom Hearts, this one plays out via a series of fairly shallow minigames, like a ton of minigames stitched together. And we just did a lot of Final Fantasy VII podcasts, and we were just sort of astounded by seeing how many ways they use minigames in VII. And I feel like the same spirit is still alive in Kingdom Hearts, the same spirit of that era. Like everything is a minigame. There are so many minigames. There's so many minigames in battle. Like he is very obsessed with this idea of the mini game, which I find pretty fascinating. And also, I kind of want him to move on from that idea.
Well, in some cases, they can't avoid a mini game. In the 100-Acre Wood, you're not allowed.
Match three games, basically.
I got oddly into that, even though I hated it. Yeah. I was like, oh, here it comes. I was like, I like this puzzle game.
Yeah, but you can't have violence in there. Like the estate says no violence, no swords. So you're going to be, you know, rolling pumpkins at your apricots or whatever.
It does feel like an old school mindset because my theory was those old games relied so much on minigames because there was not enough technology available to really develop one 3D concept. So they had to move between a lot of them. And I want Nomura to realize like, no, you have so much technology at your fingertips. Like things like so there'll be some light spoilers if you don't want to know about what worlds are in the game. You're listening to the wrong podcast. But things like the Pirates of the Caribbean level, I thought like this could be a full game, like sailing from island to island and doing all these things. But it just every idea is so shallowly developed. I feel like none of them are given the treatment they need. There are a lot of good ideas and a lot of bad ideas, but I feel like there's an obsession with a variety, and that was very much the idea behind these early 3D games, where it's like, we can't give you this big 3D experience, so here's like a lot of little things we can have you have fun with.
I think they did a good job of picking films that connect thematically to the idea of finding hearts and making connections. And like the Pirates actually ended up being one of the most connective, because the end giant battle at the end of Pirates of the Caribbean 3 is them fighting over a heart in a box.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is basically Kingdom Hearts as well. Like, and it fit too with the continuing subplot of Maleficent and Peg Leg Pete going like, we're looking for a box. That's right, Maleficent.
Yeah. Is that box from the mobile game too or something?
Oh, yeah.
Like that? Yeah. Yeah, I thought so.
I can tell you a lot about that box if you really want to know.
You can't name something a black box. It means something else.
You don't know what's in it. It's a secret. And you won't know at the end of three either.
No, you see it.
So, yeah. Did a plane go down or something in Disneyland?
It's their tie-in to Lost, which is also a Disney property.
Well, you see, Bob, when the Master of Masters 100 years ago, before the Keyblade War, he handed off to the foretellers a prophecy and a box that is not allowed to be opened. And to the fifth foreteller, that was Lushu, he was like, you cannot open this box. And who is Lushu? I wonder. But he hid that box for the longest time.
He was taken from Mushu, I assume.
And then he started the Keyblade War, which like killed everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, the mobile games is him building Kingdom Hearts 4.
Yeah, it feels like it. Yeah.
It's all set up for Kingdom Hearts 4. But so don't really pay attention to that now.
But another throwback in this series is so I feel like it is very much like this game feels like it comes from like a 2000 mindset, like the year 2000, just the way it's developed and the way he goes about building this game, and that there's an obsession with a lot of these ideas that were very novel in the early era of 3D gaming that we've moved on. Like photography is a thing, which is cool because now, you know, selfies are a thing in a lot of games, but it feels like a very much find the things in the world and take photos of them to, you know, unlock things. That feels like Dead Rising, that was like a novel thing 13 years ago.
I enjoyed it in Dark Cloud 2.
Dark Cloud
2.
Yeah. Like things like that feel like very much like they would be more novel if exploring these 3D worlds was still new. And also ideas like snowboarding mini games and grinding on things. Like these are all like from
Sonic Adventure-ass shit right there.
Yeah. Like I feel like my analogy for Kingdom Hearts 3, it's like the tribal tattoo of games. Like it is very distinct in what it represents and what era it is from. And it is very dated. Even though you don't really consider like Kingdom Hearts 1 was a very good-looking game for the time. It was very, you know, high-tech, but now it is an old game. And I feel like this feels like a retro game. This feels like a PlayStation 2 game. And that sounds crazy, but if you were a kid who grew up with those games, this could be a throwback for you. I don't know if you feel that way, Katie.
Oh, sorry.
I just want to know if, like, from Katie's perspective, like, when you play Kingdom Hearts 3, you were a kid who grew up with, like, PS2. Does it feel like a throwback to you?
Yeah, for me, that's, like, what I really liked about 3 is, like, I was kind of worried they would try to make it go in a weird direction, but it does feel like a PS2 game.
Okay.
And I think that's, like, kind of cool. But then there's, like, weird things where it's, like, yo, Twilight Town, you're like, oh, whoa, there's NPCs. And that was, like, never a thing in Kingdom Hearts worlds where they're always so barren. Or, like,
in Pirates, you dance with people.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's, like, yeah, there, you can, like, swim underwater. And, like, it's not, like, horrible combat like the the Little Mermaid world, I think, which is, like, oh, so bad. But then I'm trying to think of what else. Oh, yeah, and, like, cutscene, like, would, like, transition into gameplay. And I was like, whoa, this is, like, weird. Like, I'm so used to just, like, they're just being cutscenes. And, like, they finally found a way to, like, transition into just the game. And that felt novel, which is not really that novel.
I wish they did that consistently because I hate, especially towards the end of the game where it's like very much, again, of the era of game design where it's like cutscene, run, cutscene, run to the next one. It's just like, and then fade to black between each running segment. But when they would transition from a cutscene to gameplay, it was really well done. But I think they are still a little old-fashioned about some things, especially
Nomura. I feel like you don't really hit gameplay for like at least 20 minutes in the beginning. There's so many cutscenes.
The Valkyrie profile.
It takes a long time. Yeah. Sorry, Jeremy.
That's retro PS1.
You're going to say something?
I just feel like retro PS2 games, like PS2 style retro, you know, however you want to describe it, like games that evoke the PS2 era is actually a thing that is happening. And I see it most often from smaller Japanese studios that don't have the budgets to necessarily go big, or who are like, well, let's maybe not create a game that is just trying to be Dark Souls. And so, yeah, like yesterday at GDC, I demoed a game from Furyu being published by Spike Chunsoft called Crystar. And it's extremely, extremely, like, very much this is a PS2 game with fancy, you know, modern-day graphics. And before that, there was Knights of Azure from Gust, I think, published by Koei Tecmo. And it also – it felt like – that game specifically felt like the second Castlevania game for PS2 and Xbox. Curse of Darkness, I think, was what it was called.
Yeah.
Like it was just very evocative of that. It's kind of clumsy, kind of bad, but also like it sparks something inside of me because it takes me back to when I was just a baby in the video games press and reviewing these games that were like 6.5 or 7 out of 10 and not great, but it was neat that that people made them and then they went away for a long time and now they've come back and people are like, let's make a 6.5 or 7 out of 10 game from 2004 and put it on PS4 or Steam.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what? Thank you. I need a little bit of that.
It may sound weird to listeners out there, like if you're around my age or Jeremy's age, where that the idea of a PS2 throwback is possible, but the context for what is nostalgia is always shifting. And when Retronauts started in 2006, that was the era in which you could publish an 8-bit throwback or a 16-bit throwback. And now that window has shifted.
A 10-year difference between 1996 and 2006 was Super Mario RPG versus Final Fantasy XII.
Yeah.
That's a big gap. Now, 2009 to 2019 is Demon's Souls versus Sekiro. Well, okay, that's kind of different, but not really.
That's true.
It's very much, you know, same very – I don't know.
I think the PS2 quality to it, too, comes from a scaling of, you know, vision, because they're like they just got out of the quagmire of trying to make a modern game with Versus 13 that maybe they, as a team, they're like, we should go, Nomura and his team are like, we should just go back to what we know. We can make a very sectioned off game. We don't have to make a giant open world or try to like really iterate or innovate all that much as opposed to iterate. And that's why you get all these very sectioned off worlds and this only – you're only collecting crabs in one place.
Yeah,
You're only flying on the back of a inflatable hug robot in one place.
That's –
Wait, where's – oh, inflatable hug robot.
Big Hero 6.
Big Hero 6, yeah.
That's such a great description. I love that. I want every game to have one of those.
And they actually did get Scott Adsit. They didn't get every voice actor.
Yeah.
They did get Scott Adsit.
They got Wall Sean. He needs money sometimes. Maybe Katie could comment on this because I feel like when they do a quote-unquote modern-day idea like let's build a big world for you to run around in – and then when you're like, well, what do? They kind of like get collectibles. Like there's no compelling thing to do in the big world. So like they are approaching it with an old school mindset. But when they have a newer idea, they're really not sure how to execute on it. Because like I know in the Pirates world, you collect you have to collect like thousands of crabs, hundreds of crabs. And you're in a world later where that's very big. You have to collect certain things that are moving around more. It's kind of annoying. Like and in the Big Hero 6 world, it's a big city, sort of like a GTA city, a tiny chunk of one. But it's just like it's very empty. Like I like the levels that were more designed just because it felt more in line with what they were trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree with that, especially the Monsters, Inc. world is, like, so boring, which is, like, such a disappointment because I – like, Monsters, Inc. is my favorite Pixar movie, and then it's just, like, hallway after hallway, and it feels very restrictive.
You kind of realize, oh, they're constrained to the setting of the movie, and the setting of that movie was a bunch of factories and offices.
Yeah, I guess
they could have made
use
of the doors, you know, the portals into bedrooms and stuff.
You get one scene of that.
Oh, I
love that scene, though, when they throw Ventus – Vanitas.
They're different.
Yeah, they are. They throw Vanitas into a door, then throw that door into a door, and then that door into a door, and then that door into a door, and then that door into the wood chipper. Like, it's a really fun moment.
It could have been, like, a fun, like, portally experience to jump between doors and different rooms and stuff, but I feel
that sounds hard to make, Bob.
That is too much of a non...
They only had 13 years. Come on, dude.
That is true. That's too much of a modern experience, I think, that idea of just... transitioning into a new space instantly and back, not have things like this is a room, that's another room, things like that. Like, I feel like this game is very much of that mindset and of Nomura's mindset, too.
And things that actually felt like a real sequel was the gummy ship really does just fly around in open space. And I hate the gummy ship in every game before this, and it's actually all right here.
I actually designed mine, like customized it. I'd always do like the default whatever blueprint, but I actually like put like a dog on it and made it like look cool.
As usual with these games, I built one ship once and that was it. But I was impressed that they did make it more ambitious and they did make it as playable as it could be. But it still feels like unnecessary that sort of travel between levels. Just because, again, it's very much of this mindset, like this game should need to be everything. It should be a shooter, too, on top of everything we're trying to do, which was, again, it's part of that early PS2 mindset. Like, here is a shallow version of several experiences just to give you as much as we can.
But I also like, functionally, with the gummy ship in the game, it's almost pointless because often when Sora needs to go somewhere, he lets his heart be his guiding key, and it's just like, oh, it opened up the teleporter to the place I got to go. Let's just fly through that. It's just, why don't you do – I mean, if you're going to do that in the story, just do that every time. Why even make us fly places?
Yeah, I forgot story-wise, it's kind of unnecessary even then. Only when they need a scene of you talking to Chip and Dale or like sharing a moment with Goofy and Donald.
Those guys are fun.
They are fun. Let's talk about the combat. Katie, you have a lot to say about this. I found it – I was expecting that there to be a lot more to it. I feel like this could be like a Disney restriction. But in all of the games, the combat has like no impact. It feels like you're just batting around like hollow Christmas ornaments or something. And they don't even make like impactful sounds when you hit the enemies. It feels like Disney is saying – stepping in and saying this cannot be violent. Like it has to be non-impactful violence. It has to be fun violence if you're going to be swinging around swords. But I was expecting more of an evolution of the combat, but it feels like – ultimately, you can do this very artlessly. You can mash X button and then go into these different mini games with summons and summoning rides and doing different transformations with your Keyblade. Things I expected to be developed more like magic and parrying and blocking, they were just like they were in older games. I'm sure they're better, but they still feel like not necessary to engage with at all. I mean, did you find yourself engaging more with these systems that were kind of unnecessary in the past games?
I was definitely using magic more, which I never would touch magic except for like cure, obviously. And I feel like for the form changes, I think, made me switch up my keyblades more. Because usually I just use the strongest one, but I would like switch it depending on the world. Like, oh, there's like a lot of flying enemies here. So I'm going to use like this weird like Winnie the Pooh one that turns into guns because I guess.
Is that the lock-on one? My husband used that one a whole lot.
Yeah, there's like – and then like the Big Hero 6 one's like pretty good. Like I would like switch it up and you can like have multiple equips, so I'd like switch between them a lot. And I felt like there was like more variety in that sense, whereas, yeah, you hit X a lot, and I feel like that's kind of what these games have always been.
You hit X until you can hit triangle.
Yeah, exactly.
X should be jump. I hate it. Yeah. It breaks my brain. X is jump. Yeah. I'm sorry, Japan. It's jump. It just is.
Circle is confirmed, though. Come on.
Also, let us – I know, but at least – it's 2019 and you can't change the button layout. You
that is like annoying. And then also,
it's 2002. Sorry, Henry. Sorry, Katie. Go ahead,
please.
Oh,
yeah. But the one thing I didn't like about the combat is like there's those weird like attraction abilities where you like hit there on the timer and those are so useless. Like they – like Kingdom Hearts combat is all about moving around and jumping around and just like, you know, swinging your keyblade everywhere. And often those attraction abilities just make you stationary. And it's like that's the one thing I don't want to be – in a Kingdom Hearts like combat arena. Like it doesn't make any sense.
And they're cool the first couple times, but after that you just want to get them
over
with.
They're like shiny, Like I just like would like switch to a different one in the queue or whatever because there's like the multiple ones. I'm like, I'm not even going to bother with it. It's like
and
so annoying.
The annoying thing is they activate outside of combat where it's like you have one stored up, this attraction ability that you earn through getting a lot of hits on an enemy. So once you earn one of those, you can hit the X button or sorry, the triangle button to have a summon of like a Disney park attraction like the carousel or
– I like Electric Light Parade. That's my
favorite. Really cool too. But often it's just like, okay, I'm done with the battle. I want to open up this treasure chest. And it's like, oh, did you want to summon this this pirate ship? No, I want to open the treasure chest. You have to go through all the animation until it's over. It's so weird that you can do that outside of combat. I don't know why.
Yeah, it is weird. You can cancel it, but it's always annoying.
It still takes time. But the thing is, like, I wanted there to be more to the battle system. I did use magic more, but then I realized, oh, this takes more time, so I'm not going to do this. And things like they give you all of these abilities for blocking and parrying, but I found that there's
I never block.
I want there to be more developed here, though, because I feel like there's so much chaos on the screen and the enemies don't have really like tells before they attack. Like, I don't know who actually can use those abilities because they seem really cool. Like, there are so many abilities built around parrying and blocking and things like that, but I did not use any of them at all.
Man, just imagine if they – like with Nier Automata, they got Platinum to help design like combat in this. Like, that would be – but I feel like Nomura wouldn't want to work with somebody else to do the combat. He would do it his way.
I mean, I interviewed the co-director of Kingdom Hearts 3 at GDC.
Oh, cool.
Tai Yasui. And he's like the gameplay guy, basically. And he's been on since the Kingdom Hearts 2 remix. And he's like co-directed a few of the spinoffs, but has had a role. He's basically only worked on Kingdom Hearts, pretty much. But, yeah, it seems like they just wanted to keep it true to the Kingdom Hearts way, which is, like, easy. And then they're patching in a higher difficulty within the next couple of months or something.
Well, my husband actually, he now is playing it on harder difficulties for – he wants to platinum it because he's crazy. But he first played it on the easiest difficulty because he's like, I have to just experience all this story now. Like, the story for him was very important because they'd been building it for so long. They created so many side stories and side quests and all these millions of extra characters. There's two different Organization 13s. Everybody has different nobodies and somebodies and heartless and all this stuff. Like it's so ridiculously complex and all these lead up things. But I will give them credit of like, you know, if you wanted completeness to those, a lot of those stories, they gave it to you. They gave you like a satisfying conclusion to character arcs from characters from Birth by Sleep and 358 over 2 days as well.
358. Say the whole number. Yeah, I mean, not to spoil anything, like the end of the game is like this game is backloaded with the lore where it's like the Disney stuff is the formality and then it's just like a lore quagmire. It's like everybody gets their moment. Everyone gets their boss fight. And if you are new to the series or you've not played the series in a while, it doesn't care. Like, you need to know why this is meaningful.
That's kind of retro PS1. I'm thinking like Metal Gear Solid where...
Yes, exactly.
It's very much
Let me tell you about the Sons of Big Boss.
But I will, 20 minutes.
I think again, it's okay if you enjoy this, but I feel like this makes Kojima feel like a master of just brevity and conciseness. And he knew this all along. Like, it feels like he's able to fake it better. And I think he had the benefit of being in control more and not having to rely on other IP rights and things like that. So he has a lot going for him. But I have more respect for him now of being like, boy, you're a better magician than Nomura is in terms of being a storyteller.
Well, the ending too, the ending boss rush, I won't get too spoilery in it, but the boss rush kind of last 5 hours of the game.
It's so long.
It also feels like they just delayed finales to so many games, and then they just do them all at once that it makes me mad. I'm like, you could have just had this ending before. You didn't have to hold all these back to happen in three at the same time. So then they lose their importance, you know, when like five characters all return in the same like basically 40 minutes of you playing the game. They're important, but they all happen so much. You're like, I can't. I'm just thinking about the last character that got resurrected. Now you bring back another character.
Well, now it sounded like Metal Gear Solid 4.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. You can compare a lot. Yeah, actually, that's a good comparison because it is 4 is like, okay, we need to finish all of these stories.
It's very
immediately.
Similar. Also, there's a Revolver Ocelot type guy in the game, too. Like, he's very.
Just say that.
And another thing about. This was something that pissed me off the most in Cage 3. I'm curious, Katie, how you felt. Like, Dreamed Up Distance made a big promise that Kairi was a Keyblade wielder.
Right,
now.
Right.
And she doesn't do shit.
She's
and is kidnapped once again.
Yeah, it's that was like the one thing that like really annoyed me because I feel like this whole series has just like pushed Kairi as a character around, like the one like notable female character in the whole series besides Aqua, I guess, who's also like. Doesn't really get her big moment. Which
they tell
really
her like, okay, it's not. I can do this. They're like, actually, Sora's gonna do this. Go over
and
there.
And Aqua's like one of the, like, in theory, the most powerful Keyblade Master like existing at the moment. And then she
on
like,
paper,
yeah, you know, on paper. And then she doesn't even get her like big moment. She like is like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Didn't Mickey imprison her in some sort of thing?
No.
Is that a spoiler? I'm sorry.
She sacrificed herself to save Terra that sent her to the dark place, which is also where Mickey went to at the end of Kingdom Hearts, where she then ran into Aqua. Uh-huh. And he knew Aqua from his Mark of Mastery thing that he did 10 years before the first Kingdom Hearts.
I have no context for this, but I love the guilt-riddled Mickey who lives in a world of his own hell, just of his own making. He may, like, I don't even understand what's happening. I just love, like, I've committed so many sins. Like, that Mickey. It's so different than the Mickey I know.
Well, I am sad that we just
it's
have.
Like the Gottfried Mickey.
Yeah.
speaking of actors who've passed away, like, that, it's not the Mickey of the first games, too. And that guy will never sound like Mickey to me. It's
same
a
here.
Very similar voice, but it just feels wrong. I just don't. But yeah, that when you get to see all seven Keyblade Masters together, like it's a really cool moment. And then fucking Kairi gets like shoved aside again.
Yeah,
and it just sucks.
Yeah, even
and
I noticed
like, damseled,
that.
She's like damseled, like, and it's like, I think it's just super frustrating that she was held up to finally be getting like she summons the Keyblade in two, and it's like a big moment, and it's like, oh, she's gonna be training to become a master, and it's like, oh, this is sick. She's finally gonna be like maybe a playable character like Riku is at sometimes, but.
Yeah, I mean, even as a dabbler in the series, I playing 3, I was like, I thought the connection between Sora and Kairi was like one of the fundamental things in the series.
It is,
where it's so important in the first game, and she is just like, they barely acknowledge each other in 3 when they're in the same scene together.
Yeah, I mean, Riku is the real connection Sora has here. I'm not trying to just talk about like, you know, slash fiction or everything, but like... a joke within the Cage community is that in Cage 2, you compare the reactions of when Sora first meets Kairi again to when he first meets Riku again. When he meets Kairi, he is happy. But when he meets Riku again, he literally drops to his knees in front of him.
Oh, my God.
And it's like, Riku.
Are they your OTP once you're pairing?
Yeah. No, I mean, well, and then also Axel and the blue-haired guy. God, what's his name? Issa? No, not Issa. Whatever.
I know. I can picture him.
Like. Yeah, exactly. There are literally 26 names of characters just in the Organization 13. You can't be. And then you have Vanitas, You have Ventus. You have Anidus, who looks like Sora, and then you have Ventus, who looks like Roxas, who also sort of both look like Sora. Like,
this is great.
And then Joan, who's like black-haired. Yeah,
there's Shion and Naminé, who both look like Kairi, but for different reasons.
Mm-hmm. As a wrestling fan, Henry, this is compared to the wrestling lore?
Pretty similar, I'd say, actually. Yeah, and it pays off being an obsessive about it, though I will say nobody becomes a clone of themselves in wrestling.
Like, who's the Undertaker in this game?
Yeah.
Zemna? No. Marluxia. I'd say Marluxia. That's who I'd say is the Undertaker. Or who's also known as Lemu. Like, he's one of the guys who existed in the Keyblade War, as you saw in the past, alongside boy. Well, the cool thing, you know, the Final Fantasy connection, I didn't know this until my husband pointed out that every member of the Organization 13, the one from the DS game, they all are class types from Final Fantasy.
Oh, that's really cool.
Like, one's a bard, one's a dragoon.
I feel like I could have just left the mics on and had Henry do this whole podcast himself. One thing I wanted to mention is that my last thing, I want to do a few listener comments, but one thing I really wanted to mention was there's a really cool thing in this game that I thought was one of the coolest things in a Kingdom Hearts, where there are many mini-games. Some of the coolest ones that are in Kingdom Hearts 3 are these collection of early LCD games. Like, they are mock-ups of, like, Game & Watch games.
I love
where
that.
Sora is the star. So it's sort of like Mickey Mouse, his earliest works are black and white cartoons, and Sora, his earliest works are LCD games. That is such a cool idea. And, like, they are like, you could make these LCD games. Like, they follow the rules of LCD games.
One is so much just like Vermin. Like, one is really the Game & Watch game Vermin, and another really feels like the Donkey Kong Jr. Game & Watch. I'm a Game & Watch super fan, so yeah, seeing that, the Game & Watch gameplay was on those mobile games, and I told my husband, and he was playing, I'm like, boy, these look really cool. He's like, yeah, you haven't played them for 8 hours to try to get a sword, a different sword in this game.
Yeah, I wonder what like kids think of those now. Like, are those actual? Like, are these things that are real? They probably don't even know what they are.
I wonder. I love that stylistically about them, though. It's a really cool choice.
Can you speak to the youth perspective, Katie?
Do you know LCD games, Katie?
I know of them. Okay. Yeah, you know, I've been to some like barcade things.
Oh, okay.
Events. Things I played a few. I know what the Game & Watch is.
I think they still exist in keychain form. You know, you can still buy crappy keychains. Yeah. So before we go, we've got a few comments on the Retronauts blog, so thanks for leaving them if you did. And these are really short, so I'll just go through them really quickly before we wrap up. So Smug Porky says, 3 is by far my favorite one in the series as far as gameplay is concerned. It's the first game in the series that felt to me like it knew exactly what it wanted to be, and I had fun playing it from start to finish. All the other games, including parts of 2 and Dream Drop Distance, came across like they were trying to test some new mechanic that either wasn't fully thought out, could be easily ignored as part of the main gameplay loop, or was just plain old not fun, looking at you, chain of memories. And as a result, were a chore to play through. 3 takes the best bits from those respective systems and mechanics, simplifies them, and combines them into a combat system that I actually have fun with and want to use to its fullest extent. It's a shame that it took this long to truly find Kingdom Hearts gameplay, but now I can say I am truly looking forward to whatever the series, the next entry in the series may be. And he says, on another note, while I appreciate the amount of voice Scrooge McDuck content in 3, I wish they went with David Tennant from the new show and not whoever is doing that not-so-great Alan Young impression. And I totally agree. I was about to delete the game personally when he said, bless my bagpipes and not bless me bagpipes.
Boo.
What were you thinking, voice director? Make him say it again.
You know, there are a few non-union equivalents in this game. I'm not a fan. Well, I think the worst, my least favorite, is Woody. I think Woody doesn't sound
it's so
anything.
Bad.
It's
yeah.
a really
is that
bad.
Tom Hanks's brother? Or?
No, they couldn't even get him.
Oh my god!
It's like below that. Yeah,
it's actually Frank Stallone. They found some other celebrity's brother.
It's just like so nothing. Even though he gives like actually a pretty. My husband showed me again. Like, oh, this is a funny speech he gives of like, you, nobody loved you. That's I can tell that from how you're acting. But our people love us. It's a really weird speech that given by
Woody
of all characters.
The cowboy.
Also, in general, there's like some really good stilted voice acting that I thought was really funny. Like there's like weird pauses between laughing.
My God.
And it felt like very like PS2-esque. Of, it's like they're definitely just reading in a script, like not bouncing off anyone else, and it's really
and it's
funny.
Like acting as if the next line of dialogue needs to be loaded
exactly
from
it's
the
like,
DVD.
So
before Sora starts the final boss battle, they all all the characters talk to each other of like, well, you're about to start this final boss battle. That's right. Everyone, which is more than eight characters, all have to nod and go, It's a minute. Like, it's a minute. I'm like, guys, the end of the world is right there. Maybe you don't all have to agree to this with a nod.
They can just all nod together.
There's it really stands out in the Tangled world, where they recreate a scene from Tangled that has incredibly like snappy comedy to it and really quick edits. That I was like, I haven't seen Tangled. I know this is taken from Tangled because they would never make something this fast paced in Kingdom Hearts ever.
So our final comment is from Seth Finkelstein, who says, I spent so long wondering what Kingdom Hearts 3 would look like on an HD console, how they would handle modern Disney films, how the storylines would conclude. At the end of the day, I know I was disappointed, but there is no way I wasn't going to be. There's so many layers of nostalgia baked into this game. Nostalgia for the series, nostalgia for Disney, nostalgia for PS2-era games. But playing the game couldn't transport me back to 2005 when I sat in the basement beating Kingdom Hearts 2. It can elicit something similar or familiar, but now as an adult, it wouldn't feel exactly the same. At the end of the day, everyone has their thing from adolescence that they will defend or raise up as a superior product because of the time in their life they discovered it. Perhaps it's a certain anime or superhero comics or vintage NES games. For me, and my guess is a lot of late 90s, early 2000s kids, it was Kingdom Hearts. It taught me how established properties can be launching pads for original stories and how the limitations of corporate interests can create overcompromise and underproduce. So no matter how long Kingdom Hearts 4 takes to come out, I'll still be there day one to try and grab a piece of my childhood again. And that is very insightful. That's a very good way to wrap up this podcast because as an outsider, I don't understand the love for the series. But nothing can explain nostalgia. Like, it is very much being there at a point in time. And I think Retronauts is very much about that. We were and, like, how our feelings were different and informed by our childhoods.
Yeah, I'm sure people who love Kingdom Hearts are like, what the hell is wrong with you that you love Clash at Demonhead, Jeremy Parrish? And all I can say is I was, like, 14 years old. So there you go.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think
all of our opinions are not logical.
I like it as a window into what people younger than me loved about a game, and it's and also I love in a way how shitty it is or how complicated it is. Like it's all needlessly so. It talks to my heart as a fanboy who likes other convoluted garbage my whole life. So I can love it from that direction and also as a continuity nerd, love like giving myself an A in memorizing character names.
It's the most important thing. Yeah, I mean, the last thing I ever want to be, especially for this podcast, is to be like the my nostalgia is a true nostalgia. And something that irks me is people that didn't get the memo where it's like they think, oh, it's okay to make fun of this thing, right? We all hate this thing. It's like, no, people like that. You're just old. And I don't want to become one of those people. So you know what? Have fun with Fortnite. Play your Battle Royales. They're all good. Enjoy Kingdom Hearts. It might not be my thing, but you're free to enjoy it, and it might mean something to you. So to wrap up, everybody – oh, we got something else?
Sorry, there was one last –
I had the perfect ending, Henry.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There was – I forgot to talk about Viram Rex.
Oh, good.
Because if you think Nomura is mad about being kicked off of Versus 13 – Viram Rex expresses that because
That's true.
In Toy Story
now,
world,
is that like T-Rex from Toy Story like gone mad or something?
His arms are better.
T-Rex actually loves Viram Rex. It's one of his favorite games. But no, it's a video game in the world of Toy Story. And the second you see it, you're like, this looks like Final Fantasy 15, except what the trailers for Versus 13 were. There's a character who is very much an Octus. There's very much a Prompto and an Ignis. Like, there's just no Gladius. It's just three characters. And they get in robots and fight other things, which was conceptually the mech fighting thing was what Nomura wanted in Versus 13 that they cut for 15. And Viram Rex means true king. So I feel like this is him being like, I'm making this real Final Fantasy 13. You took it away from me. Fuck you. Here it is. And now I'm just going to call it Viram Rex. Like, I'm wondering if he's going to do just his own Viram Rex game If I mean, he won't complete a game. That's not going
to happen. I'll look forward to that in 2037.
It's very funny because the characters in that world love the game. It's a big hit.
It's the greatest game. They're like, oh, I love this game, right? That was – seeing Verum Rex was quite a mind blower the first time.
So, yeah, Henry, thank you for – I did think that was important to say on the show because I had no idea what to make of that scene when I saw it in Kingdom Hearts 3. But we do need to wrap up. Katie, you're our special guest and the Kingdom Hearts expert. Please let us know where we can find you and your writing and everything like that. And I recommend that everyone read your Kingdom Hearts review. I enjoyed it a lot. Helped me process my feelings for the game.
But yeah, you can find me on Twitter. That's twitter.com/YumeKatie. I have a podcast called Bad End. We just launched Patreon last month. And
ooh,
we're,
congrats.
Yeah, very exciting. We thought we were going to make like $20. We're already over 100, which is cool. So I think it's just patreon.com/badend. And you can also find my work on usgamer.net. I write there most days and edit stuff too.
Well, Katie, if I may compliment you, I really enjoyed your Tetris Effect review because I also am a very nearsighted person, and so it felt good to read somebody else having the same problem. I thought I was alone and like having to squint at this game. Like it just is so. If you're not playing on a gigantic TV, that game has very granular details that are hard to parse out. But if you don't have perfect eyesight,
yeah.
So thanks.
Hey, Jeremy, how about you?
Me. I didn't review Tetris Effect, no. Oh, you're asking about where to find me on the internet, right? You can find me on Twitter as GameSpider and doing Retronaut stuff. There you go. Wait. Maybe I should talk about my videos.
Yeah, that's
one
too.
More thing. Let me just throw that in.
You make a lot of videos.
I do make a lot of videos. Check it out on YouTube. Look for Jeremy Parrish. That's me. It's P-A-R-I-S-H.
And I'm H-E-N-E-R-E-Y-G on Twitter. You can follow me there for updates on my thoughts on video games. But more importantly, updates on the podcast I do every week with Bob Mackey. Me and him have two weekly podcasts. One, Talking Simpsons, where we go through the entire history of The Simpsons, one episode at a time. And another, What a Cartoon, where we go through a different animated series and talk about a specific episode from it with tons of cool guests, sometimes even Jeremy Parrish. And if you like some of the... actually, you know, we didn't talk that much about Disney animation in this, but if you'd like to hear more talk about that, you can listen to those podcasts, including, if I may suggest, our premium $10 a month What a Cartoon movie podcast. We did one for a Goofy movie that I'm very proud of. You get to hear the real range that Bill Farmer has as Goofy, which you will not hear an ounce of in Kingdom Hearts. He is very plainly acting.
This Goofy has nothing on the Goofy in a Goofy movie, I will
nothing
say.
Nothing at all.
Disney Classic coming soon to Blu-ray, everybody. But as for us... well, actually, as for me, number one, I'm Bob Mackey. I'm on Twitter as Bob Servo. But as for us, Retronauts-wise, we are on Patreon. And for the low price of $3 a month, you can get every podcast 1 week ahead of time and ad-free and at a higher bit rate. And that sounds pretty cool, doesn't it? That supports everything that we do. This nice studio space, snacks for our guests. It flies Jeremy out here to record stuff. It pays for equipment. It does everything you can imagine a podcast could possibly involve. And podcasting is very expensive. So if you want to support the show, please go to patreon.com/retronauts and sign up today. We'd appreciate it a lot. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode. Goodbye. Thank you.